Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. Very excited today because I have with me Lindsay Davis, who's a much published author writing historical fiction. And she's here to talk to us about her new book, which is the ninth book in the Flavia Albia series. Hello, Lindsay.
Hello.
Oh, I'm very much looking forward to this because you've created a very unique character, haven't you?
I think I have. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
We'll get to that in a second. So tell us about her. Tell us about the previous books. As I said, this is number nine. And who is Flavia?
Well, before Flavia, there were 20 books that I wrote about her father, the legendary Marcus Didius Falco, which I started. The first one was published in 1989. So I'm somewhat feeling like an old lady as I relate this story to you. I wrote them one a year for 20 years, and then I thought I wanted to have a change. So first I wrote a completely different Roman sort of novel, which was about the reign of the Emperor Domitian. And then when it was clear that my readers and publishers desperately wanted more Falco, I gave them not more Falco because I really felt I'd done enough with that. But I started a new series about his adopted daughter who has been found in Britain. So she has a slightly mixed heritage. I think when I started in the 1980s, there was so much to do with fiction about the ancient world. It wasn't anywhere near as common as it has become. And I had to explain so much about the Roman world that to have added in a female protagonist at that time would have been one step too far, really, because one of the questions I'm sure you're going to ask me is, could a woman really do her job? That's what I'm setting out to show. So 9 books ago, and in fact 9 and a half books to go, because I'm halfway through the next one, I set out to write this new series with a slightly different slant and set 12 years after the previous series had ended. So we've changed from good Emperor Vespasian, who built the Colosseum and made Rome prosperous, to his evil, paranoid tyrant son Domitian, who is wonderful fun to write about, actually.
It's brilliant. Like, we were talking about whether to introduce you as a historian or historian author or author beforehand, and you said you don't class yourself as a historian in the strict sense of the word, but you've spent more than 30 years, writing about ancient Rome. What made you want to spend your writing life in ancient Rome?
I didn't really think about it. I just wanted to find something that nobody else was doing, which now you couldn't say, but then you could say, because I thought you had to be original. And I had run away from my job as a civil servant and needed to do something with my life, and thought I'd reached a point in life where I would try to be a writer. My academic background is English, in English language and literature, both parts. I think both parts are useful to a writer. And so I don't push the fact that I've wandered into the realms of historians and classicists and even archaeologists. Mm-hmm. I just get on with what I do and wait for them to notice that actually I'm not making a bad fist of it.
But I think it's interesting, isn't it, because you do get, as a historian who has done some fiction, I find I very much can't let go sometimes. Maybe you find it easier to let go and say, like, this is fiction, it's okay not to be completely, as long as it's possible, it doesn't have to be probable.
Exactly. And if something is not known, I feel free to use intelligent guesswork. I don't think there's any point writing historical novels unless you try to make them as authentic to what we think we know as possible. Otherwise you might just as well do fantasy.
This is brilliant. And so with that in mind, she does have a unique role in your ancient world, doesn't she, Flavia?
She does. She's the same as her father. She's what was called an informer. There were two kinds, as far as I can see. One of them hid behind pillars and tried to find out things from bad motives. They would try to get people convicted, often wrongly, so that they could earn money, and the emperors, bad emperors, could earn money from prosecuting people. And so they had a terrible reputation, which is always good, because if you're writing a detective series, you want your person, whether it's man or woman, to look slightly seedy and downtrodden and despised by the public. So that was a really good start. And then they had other informers who just sort of delivered subpoenas and did legal work like that. So when they're pushed for cash, my two can do that, but it's boring, so I don't write about it.
Mm. So she has had a traditional role in that she has been married, hasn't she, your character?
She has been married, very briefly. I didn't want to write about her. At the point when I left her in the end of the Falco series, she was only 17. Mm. And I didn't want to write about a teenager or someone who was learning the job. So I moved her on till she's almost 30, which by coincidence was how old Falco was when I started to write about him. And then I had to fill in the life that she led, and I was going to give her a very suitable gent to be her partner, but I didn't want her to have spent 30 years not having had any sort of life. So she has, as a young girl, she's been married to a character we know from the Falco stories, who is Lentulus, the dimmest recruit in the Roman army. The joke about Lentulus is that if he saw a big hole with a notice saying danger, beware big hole, he'd go across to have a look and fall in. And I thought she probably outgrow Lentulus, so I had to kill him off. And he's killed off in a very Lentulus sort of accident, where they're building the Colosseum. They've put up the central ceremonial arch, and they're adding a quadriga with four pawing horses to the top, and a leg falls off one of the horses, and Lentulus stands there going, oh, look, a leg's fallen off, and it hits him and kills him. Which is just what absolutely would happen to him, my character, who I invented, of course. So she's moved on. She's a widow. She's experienced life. She's not been entirely unhappy. I think their marriage was probably a good marriage, though short. And she's learned her job. But when we first meet her, she damn well knows what she's doing and isn't going to stand any nonsense from anybody else. And part of my way of writing her is to show that although textbooks, slight sneer on face here, imply that all women in the Roman world were simply ciphers because they had no legal identity, my feeling is that if you look at things like tombstones, in most of the world that isn't senatorial or imperial, the unit was the family, and the unit was the husband and wife partnership, and they worked together. As throughout history, in many situations, the family did have to work, children as well, to all pull together and keep things going. And so she holds down a job. She's been taught by her father, who's a man, but she knows how to do it. And part of the flavour of the books is to show situations where a man would have it a lot easier, like if she has to go and see the police. They despise her, and she has to, each time she goes to a different cohort, she's got to make her way and make them trust her and make them willing to work with her. So that's part of the fun of it.
Tell us about the setup in terms of policing in ancient Rome.
You've got your Praetorian guards at the top who look after the emperor. You've got your urban cohorts whose job is to suppress riots. And then you've got the chaps who really do the work in Rome. And they are basically, they're the fire brigade. They were set up by the Emperor Augustus to stop massive fires in Rome, which at the time was partly built of wood, though he claimed he made it marble. And every kind of cooking and lighting was naked flame. So they were very subject to feckless people setting their houses on fire and then it spreading like mad. So he set up seven cohorts to look after two districts each. And as they went around the streets sniffing for smoke, they kept running into burglars and people, because it was dark when they did their sniffing for smoke. And so they gradually became the police force as well.
That's really interesting. I'd never even considered whether, because obviously we don't really have a police force as we recognise one now in Britain until the 1800s, do we? So
no, we don't. No. And even the fire brigade was, when it was first set up in our country, was sort of a commercial enterprise rather than a civic organisation.
Is there any evidence remaining of ancient cases for you to take your stories from?
Hardly any. In the very first RBS story, I had found a historical reference to people running around the streets and stabbing people at random with poison needles. So that sort of got evidence, and nothing is said about who it actually was. So I'm free to have Albia solve it. But more often I'm inventing a crime. I try to invent a crime that could actually have happened in ancient Rome, but that leaves us with human nature, which leaves us with serial killers and domestic murders. There always have to be murders.
Yeah, I suppose as well, human nature doesn't change, does it? So
No. The motivation is always going to be greed or sex or just losing your temper when you're drunk. And that works as well 2,000 years ago as it would do here. I have made a joke that the earliest known murder case, of course, happened in Rome, and it was Romulus killing his brother Remus. So... there's precedent going back a very long way.
There is. We've mentioned this already, and you said you knew that I'd ask you this. How likely is it that there could have been a woman doing this job in ancient Rome?
I personally think, why not? Mm. We know that there were women who in their own right had jobs. My very first book, I wrote about Vespasian's mistress, who was a secretary. Never thought I'd write about a secretary. My mum would be upset by that idea. And I've written about a hairdresser. Those are jobs you would expect women to have, but why shouldn't they have other sorts of jobs if they've got the skills? And with Albia, I like to show the kind of skills she has to use, dealing with people, working things out, going to libraries and looking things up.
This is what I like about her. I suppose to be in this job in ancient Rome, she's got to have a bit about her. And I love how outspoken she is.
Yes.
She just takes no crap, does she?
No, she doesn't. I've made her, I think, very British in that.
So the book kicks off with a murder of a figurine seller that Flavia discovers with her two nephews that she has adopted. It's quite a detailed moment. And I know that Alina liked how shocking it was. It was a little shocking, she said, in her way. It surprised her.
Yes.
Do you purposely try? And I mean, I suppose, like, it's not even breaking the mold. I mean, in a way, you've created the mold for this ancient fiction, haven't you?
Yes, but a murder story is a murder story. You always have the discovery of the body. And I'm now on my 30th murder story, so I don't want it every time to be the same. This was... If it's a murder, I'll just throw that at you. It's shocking, partly because she's got two very young children with her when she discovers it. Mm. And they're on a sort of Christmas present buying mission. So the situation is shocking. There's blood. Apparently there's blood, which, again, is always shocking. And she has to decide what to do in an alien place with two little boys who don't understand quite what's going on. So that gives it an extra slant.
I know that Alina is obsessed with Roman festivals and parties. And you just mentioned, this book is set during the festival of Saturnalia as well. Did you enjoy the research that goes with that in terms of finding out all of it? Tell everybody about this festival and why it was so cool to set it then.
This is actually the second time I've done Saturnalia because it is just so wonderful to write about. It's the forerunner of Christmas without the baby in the cradle. Though I have a joke in this particular Albia story where her maid has heard a story about a baby having been put in a manger in a cradle somewhere, and they both agree that would be deeply unhygienic and isn't considered. Everything else that happened at Saturnalia, we have taken over. So they're going to buy little figures, but they're the predecessor of Christmas presents. Mm. there are lights, there are decorations in the house, which goes horribly wrong, of course. Everybody goes to a lot of parties and eats and drinks too much. There is absolutely disgusting drinking going on in the streets and everywhere you go. So it's like actually very modern version of Christmas, not Victorian. It is a lot of fun to write about. It gives a very colourful background. And then, of course, there's two things. One is the emperor, to show he's wonderful and benign, gives a huge party, which is one that was described in a Latin author I despise. So that's fun. And then it's a good contrast that part of my story is very dark because there's a sort of mafia gangster element, which I have from time to time. So you get a really good contrast.
How prevalent is organized crime as we think of it in ancient Rome?
We think it probably existed. Mm. They certainly had crime. Whether I'm elaborating too much, I don't know. It's fiction.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't have to be right, does it?
It doesn't have to be right. And I've always found things that could be used by organised criminals. And in this one, we have the nuts that are thrown at Saturnalia, and the gangsters are trying to muscle in on the people who've traditionally sold the nuts in a way that's like the ice cream wars in Glasgow a few years ago. Their methods are the same, horribly brutal, and their goods, their nuts, are not very good nuts. So there's a lot of poorly tummies in this book.
She doesn't have children, does she? But she has adopted children. Is that normal in ancient Rome? They've not lost both parents, have they?
No, they've only lost their mother.
Yeah.
Their mother was the sister of her partner, now husband, Tiberius. Mm. It was actually, they didn't have the same attitude to adoption that we have. People were adopted much more frequently. If a family didn't have an heir, for example, they just find somebody of a suitable status that they got on with and adopt him. And then the adopted person would just take extra names. So you can have people who, as well as having three Roman names, have three more Roman names, which is slightly excessive, I think. They didn't have the feeling about blood ties that we have got. And I think DNA has just exaggerated our feeling that you've got to absolutely know who you are.
There's a lot of appointing, because it happens in Ben-Hur, in my reference.
It does.
It's like, oh, well, I like you. You're my heir now.
Yes. And that's just how it would be. The Emperor Augustus was allegedly adopted by Julius Caesar. He was his great nephew. So you could adopt somebody you were vaguely related to. At the stage we're at, it's not a formal adoption with Albia and Tiberius, because they've got to tread carefully in view of the fact the father is still alive. But we know how it's going to end up. Mm. And why have I done that? Because if you're writing about a woman, it's very awkward if she gets pregnant and she's trying to do a job where she's got to be out and about. I found that with Falco and his wife, Helena, that when Helena had her two, in fact, three pregnancies, it was much more difficult for her and for me writing about her. So I don't know whether Albia ever will have her own children. I don't want to deny them the chance, absolutely, but at the moment I still feel, even nine books in, that I've only just started.
Yeah.
So I don't want to start on that yet.
Great that you found a new character like to fall in love with. Like you say, you just get to a point that you just knew you were done with Falco.
Yes, and I just knew that Albia would work. The thing that astonished me for several years was that readers of Falco didn't want to know. They were very upset that I'd left him, because they'd had him for 20 years and he was a very attractive character. And there were some who actually said they refused to read Albia. And then as they did, because I dug my heels in and I refused to give them Falco, so that was all they got, they actually ended up saying, oh, quite like her. Oh, possibly like her even more than him. Right. Good.
That's what you want.
That's what you are.
All that stuff about having worked in the service industry for many, many years, all that stuff about the customer being always right is rubbish.
Quite.
Right. Alina's devastated she's not on this, but she's been caught up in like Poland going into another major lockdown. But she's sent me the question she desperately wants me to include. And one of them she absolutely adored about the book, the detail when you talk about surroundings. So she says, like the pub and the donkey. These are the two things she's picked out. Can you run? Yeah. So how do you create that? Is it that all imagination? Or have you just built up such a wealth of understanding of ancient Rome doing all of these books that you can just see it in your head now?
I've only had one encounter with a donkey when I was three, and it was on the sands at Blackpool, and I cried and cried to be allowed a donkey ride. And then the minute I was put on it, I cried to be got off because I was so scared. So I use online resources a lot for things like that. You can find a hell of a lot about animals. In the one I'm writing now, there's a lot about a rampaging bull, and I've been reading things like wrangler sites. And for donkeys, I found a very good website that was aimed at farmers in Kenya who were going to be using donkeys as on their farms, and that was going to secure them a livelihood. And so there was a lot of advice to them about how you look after a donkey, keep it healthy and make it feel loved. And so that has transformed itself into how we look after Mercury.
Oh, that's brilliant. She's called. I just so like you can mock the sad little aviation historians all you like that do the simulations, but they're brilliant for me because someone did one of a flying boat, so I now know what it's like to sit and in a flying boat while it takes off in World War One and what it does,
yeah,
how it shakes and everything, because some little nerd has sat there and done a whole animation of it as if you're there. So it is remarkable what you find out there now, isn't it?
It is indeed.
What about the pub? Are you just going on the assumption that pubs never really will change that much?
Basically, we know what they look like because Pompeii and Herculaneum, of course, and other Roman sites, the streets are dominated by counters for fast food emporia of various sorts, and I just add to it the little I've learned from occasionally dropping into a drinking house of my own.
All for research, of course.
All for research, yes, indeed.
Yeah, I did something Elodie Harper's just done with her Wolf's Den, which I'm in the middle of reading, because we just interviewed her as well. And they all seem to be walking around Pompeii eating takeaway food, and they're in and out of bars all day long. It's fantastic.
Well, part of that is the fact that most people lived in very small accommodation. They didn't have a kitchen. This is the sort of thing that I try to draw to people's attention, that it was very rare to have your own kitchen. And even if you did, you wouldn't have a range cooker. You'd be on a little trivet messing about, and risking, of course, setting your house on fire. So most people did eat out, and many of them met in the street.
Yeah, I found that's really interesting when I was reading her book as well, that whole concept of it. And also as well, one thing I know I keep banging on about it on History Hack is the Roman lack of affiliation with privacy.
Yes.
As individual. Yeah. And they're kind of the way they regard an individual as well, as in like we very much now, like this is my body, it's my personal space. And they don't do that, do they?
Depends who you are. If you're a slave, you're a possession. You're not even a human being. If you're a citizen, you do have rights. You have rights such that you can't be taken into custody. You can't be chained because you are a free citizen. So in that sense, yes. But they didn't have the same regard for privacy, mainly, I suspect, because it simply wasn't available. So people went to the loo in giant latrines, 16-seaters, and didn't seem to mind. And I've also written about how quite often in the family situation, people made love with other people around and probably watching. It's a different view from ours. Definitely. And you have to go with it.
I was going to ask you what the most random source you've ever used is for writing your books, because we've already talked about the donkey tracking site. But in terms of the, like I say, you've done so many of them now. I suppose if this was me and I was going to write a first book about ancient Rome, I'd sit down with all the ancient Roman source material and writings I could find. Did you do that at the beginning? Do you not need to do that now?
I go back to it. I use the satirists and the historians mostly, especially the satirists. And I had some Latin in my own background, though I found it very difficult. So when I need to, I do go to usually Penguin Classics. I don't read them in the original. It doesn't have to be too hard, does it?
No, I don't think. I went to uni with this guy that would write his medieval essays. He would put straw all over the floor in a monk's habit and write them by candlelight, and we all just thought he was weird.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, I come from a big manufacturing city, and I think your tools should be suited to the job. So I've always, from the moment you could get the PC, I've had a PC.
Yeah, outstanding. If you were going to go somewhere else other than ancient Rome, have you ever felt inclined to go elsewhere in history?
I think somewhere like London in the 18th century, perhaps.
18th century. See, my brain goes 19th. I think I'm like idea of the, but then that's very much stiffer, isn't it? I think people were having a lot more fun before the Victorians,
and they were changing their attitude a lot in the 18th, which I would be interested in. I have actually written about the English Civil War at vast length. But that was horrible because it was a war, so I wouldn't want to go to it.
Oh, we should have had Charlie on with us. Here's another one of our hosts who she's just sent me actually her draft. She's done a trilogy about Barbara Villiers, historical fiction. So I'm about to dive into that and help her get it ready. Tell everybody once more about the book. What's it called? I know that Matt is going to put it on our bookshop link as well, so people can go directly to it from History Hack.
Okay, I've got to remember which one I'm talking about. It's called A Comedy of Terrors, which is a reference to Shakespeare, but also to Vincent Price.
Brilliant. Okay, so you can get that via our bookshop.org link, History Hacks page, which means that not only does Lindsay get lots of lovely sales for her book, but we get a cut as well. Thank you so much for coming on. Do come back when number 10 is ready, and we're looking forward to lots more Flavia Albia novels.
Okay, I'll be 83 if I do 20.
That's a good target. We like that. Then maybe your fans will let you off and let you retire then.
No, they won't. I know.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year, and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as a dollar a month, and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.